Succession number 28750, reel 13.
Laurie Manton, reel 13. Hope you're not superstitious, Laurie. You're going to tell me more about the Cheshires, I think.
Yeah. There's a couple of interesting points about the Cheshires. One I've never, ever in 10 years of visiting the British Army, seen such an unusual relationship between the officers and the other ranks. And though I saw it on a number of occasions, it was almost like there was no relationship between the officers. There was no comradeship. And I remember my photographer at the time commenting on it as well, hence talking about the being invited in for that meal with that Bosnian Muslim family. But the officer had turned up in his vehicle, said, "What's wrong with you lot? Oh, you've broken down," and just drove off. And didn't even bother speaking to him, you know, he abandoned the people. But, you know, I think there was a lot of jealousy about Bob Stewart getting such coverage in the papers. But then he was at Arnici. He publicly bad-mouthed, if you like, that guy that was going along saying, "You're lying, you know all about these killings and such like." But he was living in a house with some of his staff next door to the press centre, and I'd agreed that I would interview him one evening, so he came round to be interviewed by me. And I'd at that stage already interviewed over the previous 7 years hundreds and hundreds of army personnel of all ranks. And it's the first time that I interviewed someone who, what they said was so unintelligible that I couldn't get a story out of it. It was complete and utter gibberish. And when I actually wrote out the words of what the person said, because if you speak to somebody, if you interview them, if you actually, you have to interpret what they're saying, because if you actually transcribe what they're saying, sentences don't end, others start two-thirds of the way through, and on paper it looks like the biggest load of rubbish ever. That's standard. But this was worse than that. He didn't string a suitable sentence together at all, so half an hour worth of interview, and there's nothing I could really say except for Bob Stewart spoke to the soldier reporter, because the rest didn't make sense, which is very unusual, considering he was so articulate in front of the media about the situation. But I think he was unpopular because he rocked the boat a bit by being critical of the Serbs and the way people were being ethnically cleansed and maltreated and all the rest of it, which made him quite unpopular. He should have, I think, just kept his mouth shut. I think that's what the authorities would have liked him to do, which is an unfortunate situation. But he is the only person I've ever interviewed in my life of which I've got nothing from it, not even a sentence, which is...
Did you also, with him, find there was still this gulf, between him and the other ranks? Or did he...
No, he related with his men. "Hello, Fred, how's it going? All right, sir." Which is the standard sort of thing. But the other officers seemed a bit standoffish, which is perhaps something you think you might come across in a posh regiment, like the Life Guards or what have you, where a lot of the officers are actually upper class from the landed gentry. But they're, the How's It Going, Fred style as well. So it was quite, it stood out. You know, it had sort of bells and hooters going off. Very quickly you noticed that there was this this lack of relationship going on.
Did that impinge on the sort of efficiency of the unit,
no.
do you think?
No, they I don't think so. Because the army always says that it's the sergeants and corporals who actually organise the work, which they do. The officers lead, but the actual work is done by the sergeants and the junior NCOs, because they're the ones that actually command the men to do the thing. So it doesn't impinge, because the soldiers were very professional.
Was it while you were with the Cheshires that Martin Bell was wounded? Was it during that time?
I think it was around that time. I bumped into Martin Bell from time to time, and again, Kate Ady with the army again saying, gosh, if Kate's turned up, then it must be bad. you know, we are going to war and all this sort of thing. But he was a standard good BBC journalist, in my opinion. But the great danger for the media out there at the time was being drawn into the story, feeling so guilty and bad about the lack of protection for the people, that I think a lot of them became quite unpopular because their emotive and the way they described the subjects of Martin Bell was one of those. But I think it's quite justified in trying to get the story over to the public. But then, of course, you've got people back, the editors back in this country, say, oh, we can't possibly show that bit of footage because it shows a dead person. So, you know, you end up with these emotive news stories, but perhaps with a background shot of a cow in a field. So there's no reality. Whereas the Gulf was a video game, there was sort of almost like ethnic cleansing in terms of carrying stories that actually show the real suffering of the people. Now, I used to see a lot of the footage of the cameramen, not just the BBC. And to show themselves how good they were at their craft, they would, within their teams, make up videotapes of the, if you like, the outtakes, the never broadcastable material. And from time to time, I'd watch these videos. Sometimes they were a bit shocking because they set them to rock music. So you might have rock music of some sort, maybe Simple Minds or U2. But, you know, it was a succession of sequences of fighting, and there was quite a famous shot where there was a canvas-top truck with people in, and the Serbs were firing on it, and someone jumped out, and then they fired again, and the wounded chap sort of shuddered as the round went in and then crawled a bit more under the vehicle and then sort of bounced up as he was hit by another big round and all this sort of thing, and bodies and burning houses and all this sort of thing, which when you see it set to music like that, it's quite sickening in a way. But I can understand why they did it, because they see the images all the time, and you become self-protected at the how horrible the image are. Whereas it quickly showed it to you, you'd be horrified by what was seen. But I remember sitting down one day and watching a film where they'd taken the camera into a morgue where a whole load of people had been killed, shot, bombed, had their throats cut and such like. And all the bodies were laid out with blankets, and they had the elderly mothers in their sort of Black Widows outfits going round, lifting up the blankets to see if it was their relative, and every time they did, they this horrible wailing and such like. And they film for 40 minutes, and it is utterly horrendous. Utterly horrendous. But if something like that had been broadcast on television, that would have so shocked people, they would have said, well, this is ridiculous. What are we doing just letting them do all this? We must stop it at once. But it was never broadcast. So, you know, it leaves you to draw your own conclusion whether the media is to blame, i.e. the editors, say, of the BBC by saying, we can't possibly broadcast that because it would upset Mrs. So-and-so's having her evening meal. Well, they should be upset. If there's British forces there, there's piggies in the middle, they should know what's going on. And that might have ended the Bosnian conflict years early and saved hundreds of thousands of lives. But, you know, interesting footage that are going on. There was the famous Kate Adey tape where she's driving along with her cameraman and a warrior fighting vehicle slipped off the side of the road down the bank and turned upside down, and it's upside down with the people trapped inside and the track still turning, and it's her running commentary full of four-letter words. And, So, oh, what's happened? Quick, let's get over there. And they, you know, the camera's jerking as they run across the field, and Kate's on her hands and knees saying, Are you all right? You know, and these muffled voices from inside. Well, there she was involved in trying to help rescue them because there was a warrior and her vehicle that was never broadcast. But, you know, it was amazing to see this incident taking place.
Yes, so what you're saying is that reality of war is never shown.
No.
People get a sanitised view, is that right?
Mm.
Yeah.
But if people, they say, well, if you show them what's going on, they soon get used to it. But there are times when you've got a situation like that where you should show people what's going on, and it should be broadcast at peak time, you know, first 15 minutes of the 6 o'clock news. And people will be sitting there, either being sick or with their mouths wide open, and there'll be a huge outcry. And then the politicians of the day would have felt, well, you know, we really need to go to the UN. We must do something. Let's stop this now. And become peacekeepers, where you impose the peace rather than just escort these lorries through.
Do you think that's happening more now that you get stations like Al Jazeera on the sort of satellite channels, that people, you know, who tune in actually see another perception of what's happening, say, in Iraq or wherever?
No, I have my own idea, my own personal idea, not the view of the Ministry of Defence on Al Jazeera. They will broadcast everything. And I'm not casting aspersions, but my own personal opinion is that all that is doing is inflaming the Muslim world. And I think that's, they'll deny it, but I think it's a deliberate policy. And, you know, if they show the footage of you know, an American armoured vehicle being blown up by a mine, they show the whole thing, and then all the locals coming out to dance on the bodies and such like. And it feeds the frenzy of the insurgent mentality. And it's not a way of broadcasting something horrible to change public opinion to save lives. It's to encourage that we should go against the, if I was a Muslim, we should go against the Western world. So, you know, that's what I believe. That's dangerously close to being racist. But it's a propaganda station, despite what they say.
Martin Bell's wounding, would you have been there at the time, or were you involved in any way?
Well,
not with the wounding, but from the aftermath.
No, I have to laugh because there was an article in Focus, the MOD's newspaper, which describes a 68-year-old chef in the current issue who's working as a chef in main building in Whitehall. And he was a Vietnam veteran. And he said, my job was killing people in the airborne infantry. What he actually meant to say was that I was in the airborne infantry and I was trained to kill. But it looked like he was killing his own people, so it's, you know, easy to misinterpret. But I remember hearing that Martin Bell had been wounded, and that his aircraft was coming into land at Zagreb airport, being evacuated out by an RAF Hercules, and I got a chance to go along and take some photographs. There was an RAF photographer there in uniform in his combats. But his day job as an RAF photographer, and this was one of the problems arising at that line with internal military photographers, his day job was photographing cracks in airframes of aircraft. He was a technical photographer. Suddenly he found himself plucked out and sent into a war zone as a war photographer. And as soon as they dropped the back down, he leapt on the back and I leapt on the back, and he sort of wandered around looking lost, whereas, you know, I took photographs of Martin Bell on the stretcher, and then I followed him out as he was lifted up and put in the ambulance. Got quite a good shot, if you can call it a good shot, of him looking terrible from his stretcher straight at the camera. And then I decided I wanted an interview with him, which sounds terribly heartless, but he was being treated in a military hospital and was allegedly not dying. So I waited outside while they worked on him for quite some time, and he was quite badly injured. But I turned around and I realised Martin Bell's helmet, was his protective helmet, was on the ground, and it was smothered in blood. Because I document everything, then I, you know, took a number of different photos from different angles of his bloodied helmet, and I think I was probably the only person that did that. And in the event, he became too poorly to speak, and I gave up that idea. But I think that finished him off as a war reporter. Because by all accounts he was never as calm as he was in. He came back to Bosnia a few times, but he was always a bit. His hands would shake and things like that, so it affected him. And very soon he'd given up his career, and then the next thing you knew, he'd become the MP for that short while. So there was a very good war reporter who virtually ended his career when he was blown up by the water shell.
Of course, the risks are even greater today, aren't they, to reporters and photographers?
Oh, yeah, I think they're on a hiding to nothing, because there's so many people that just want to kidnap them and behead them. And I took a very, about 6 to 8 months ago, I took the decision that the next time I saw a report on someone being headed, that it appeared on an Arab website, that I would watch a hostage being killed. And that poor Daniel Perlman, the American guy, I watched him having his throat cut on my computer at home.
Not all of it, the whole process.
Yeah. And the cutting off of his head. And a couple of weeks later, was an Italian truck driver was captured, taken hostage, and then they shot him in the head. And I watched that one. And I won't watch any more. But in his case, the insurgents that stood behind him saying, Allah Akbar, you know, this is a dreadful dog of the Western world. and the guy's just sat there looking at the camera, and this guy comes up with a gun and goes bang, and the hostage just went straight forward onto the floor, it's dead. And then the film turned and the executioner just went bang, 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 you know, Allah Akbar, and look how wonderful we are, kill the crusaders and all the rest of it, and that was it. But you know, I felt I couldn't comment on those things without seeing what they actually did, whereas the Daniel Pearlman thing was absolutely horrific because it takes a long time to saw a head off with a knife.
And was he dead, you know, was he alive for part of the time?
Oh yes, because they cut the throat, the windpipe, so all you can do is gurgle. You know, you've got to, and you're alive while they're sawing backwards and forwards, which is horrendous. And now I have absolutely no, I didn't have any to begin with, but there's no chance of me having sympathy on the side of the hostage takers, who some of the more enlightened folk in Britain might say, oh, but they're freedom fighters because they're oppressed by Tony Blair's stormtroopers and Bush's, you know, Marines. Hang on a minute, these are animals, these are murderers and all the rest of it. So, yeah, it sounds terrible, me having watched it, but I felt I should just to see. But there were two different things, a complete, just like it was on telly, bang, you're dead, literally straight away. And then the horrendous sawing of this guy's throat.
Has it put you off going into, say, Iraq at the moment?
Well, it could be. I was asked to, I might be asked to, you know, if I stay in the MOD, if they don't retire me next year early, they could say, well, will you go over and do a 6-month tour as a press officer? I'd have to think about it. Because it would be 6 months of sitting in one of the protected areas. I wouldn't get out very much because I was a civilian. I'd be at risk. It would be a stress and a strain. Because it's such a badly handled area of operation, I don't think I'd want to be involved in that. And I think, you know, I think people are too at risk now. And I, having seen what happened to Daniel Pearlman, I wouldn't be able to cope with the prospect of that happening to me. You know, I've reached my threshold and I'm not going beyond it.
This issue of journalists getting too close to the story, and, you know, you have given a lot of evidence against the Serbs and their behaviour, but you've also brought in the Croats and what they were doing as well, and they're whipping up, you know, this hatred with their propaganda. Do you think it's very difficult in a situation where you have the three groups, the Serbs, the Croats and the Muslims, to be even-handed about them, reporting of same? Would you say, for instance, that the Serbs had a particularly bad press during the Bosnian War and Kosovo as well?
Well, the Serbs undoubtedly did, but it was a mad place to be in any case, because in the early stages of the conflict, the Yugoslav War, if you like, you had Croats fighting the Serbs, you had the Bosnian Muslims fighting the Serbs, and you had the Croats and Muslims fighting each other. Now, I'm minded to a time when things had allegedly settled down and the British forces were engaged in their hearts and minds thing, and I went back to Gorni Vukov. And they were now doing, because it was a peaceable place, they were now doing patrols on foot around the area. So I'd go out on patrol with the troops. And I went out with one of the British liaison officers. He said, I want to show you something very interesting. So I went with a photographer with him. And there was a telephone wire, which One end was in the Bosnian Muslim military headquarters in Gornji Vukov, and the other end was in the Croatian military area. And I'd been a signaller in the army myself, and it was what used to be known as Don 10, which was a particular telephone wire, two strand, which you connect between two telephones. You wind a handle, it makes the one ring at the other end, and you can both speak along this. And literally, between the two areas of control, there was a little copper clip which clipped the two wires together. So we were taken out to photograph the middle of this connection between the two sides. Now, bear in mind, they stopped fighting, and it was difficult to get to because we had to go up this little muddy path. And halfway along, my photographer chickened out, and it was his first visit to Bosnia, which was a real pain because the area was partially covered in anti-personnel mines that would blow your foot off. But he just ran straight back down, and I grabbed his camera and left him to it, and I went on with this guy, and he said, "Don't step there, and mind that one, and there's one there," and this sort of thing. So, got the photograph, and then we went round with him, just ourselves, without a patrol, to meet various people as we went out. And he said, "You're going to find this really interesting, bearing in mind how peaceable it is here." So it was like a private visit with this guy, and he was a bit of a spook, so to speak. He wasn't normal army. And we met this Bosnian Muslim military guy and some of his people, and he's having a chat with this guy, and our escort said, "What he's saying is, we are living for the day when the UN gets out of our town, because we're going to kill all those Croats over there." And then he took us the other side of the telephone wire to the others who were still in this peaceable town, Gornji Vukov, and they said, "When you lot have gone, we're going to kill them." So all they'd done was cease fire while they fought the Serbs, but their bitterness still remained. And I thought, I give up. I really give up. You know, it's never going to be sorted. And that really coloured my thoughts about the whole thing then, after that particular incident. I thought, this is ridiculous.
Yes.
You know, and from then on, I've always had the view they're all as bad as one another. Although the Serbs got away with the worst of it.
That's a very interesting illustration of that, isn't it? Mm. Did you also hear of the rape camps and the concentration camps? Or did you have any evidence of the existence of these?
Well, I heard the journalists talk about it. I'd never came across them myself. They're all in areas that were particularly difficult to get through, and certainly where the UN forces were unwelcome. But I remember when that female reporter got into that camp, where they showed the footage of the guy with his ribs showing, and this great big emotive thing. And I analysed that story, for want of a better expression. Now, I followed that story for some years afterwards. Now, it turned out that guy had cancer, which is why he was thin, not through malnutrition. It was obvious that their lives were in danger, and they were being kept prisoner, and they were being mistreated, and yet hardly dared say anything because there was this propaganda visit to the Serbs who were demonstrating that they were looking after their prisoners. And there was a lot of sour grapes by the rest of the British media that they hadn't got the exclusive story on this, so they tended to poo-poo the story. You know, where where, for example, you might see that the Daily Mail is running an exclusive book extract.
End of Reel 13, Laurie Manton.